Welcome to the podcast that's dedicated to making you a faster cyclist, the Ask a Cycling Coach podcast presented by Trainer Road. I'm Coach Jonathan Lee, and here with me is Coach Chad Timmerman.
Hi.
And our CEO, Nate Pearson.
Hello.
And we're here to take more of your coaching questions today, whether they be cycling or triathlon related. And you can find this podcast in a number of different places, iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or wherever else, or whatever app you use to listen to your podcast. You can find us there. Just search for Trainer Road, Ask a Cycling Coach podcast, whatever else you want to search for there. We should pop right up. And you can leave us a review on those platforms as well. We appreciate it. In fact, we even had somebody say that he wants to give us a 6-star review, guys. I don't even think that's possible.
Yes.
So
call Apple.
Right? Exactly. You can submit questions to us. And what we do is every week we get a bunch of questions and we try to answer as many as, you know, we answer as many as we can. And you can submit those at support@trainerroad.com. You can just send an email there and get them. And we comb through the questions, get the best ones that we feel that can benefit the most people, and get to every one of them that we can. So let's kick things off today. Actually, before we start with that, I wanted to plug the previous podcast we just uploaded. We had a special episode. It wasn't the three of us, but I was over at in Napa Valley, California. It's a tough life. And I was over there at the Cliff Bar team camp with the Cliff Bar team. Pretty cool stuff. We chat all about criteriums and how to be faster in them.
Yeah, Jonathan, since I'm your boss, you love your job, right? He got to leave and
job.
Go train with the Cliff Bar team and talk to him about crit raising.
Yeah, exactly. Paid. Yeah, it's pretty great. Zero complaints, only praise. So.
And you're getting a power meter, right? We just talked about it yesterday. Well, you already have a power meter, but we're buying more power meters.
I'm building up a new bike right now. Hopefully this isn't taking it off on a tangent, but if you guys follow me on social media or anything, it will be drool worthy. You'll see it in the next couple of weeks. It's like a dream bike from the ground up.
So everyone knows about Jonathan. Just get a picture of him. He obsesses. So he goes mountain biking. He obsesses over everything, clothing, tech, gear, and his mountain bike. He cleans it all the way down, and then he'll put like the tire shine wipes on his tires so that they're like shiny after every ride. It's crazy.
I take every bolt. I usually take every bolt down and check to make sure it's torqued down to spec and the whole deal too. So it's, why not, right?
Your bike looks awesome though.
Yes. And I've always said it doesn't matter if you're fast, it just matters if you look fast. That's totally not true, by the way. But anyways, let's kick it off. Let's get into Jared's question. He says, and this one's specifically to Chad, but hopefully he won't mind if I read it out. He says, Chad, hi, I'm thinking about doing your sweet spot based training plan that's 8 hours a week. That's the high volume one, right, Chad? I believe it is. So he says, I see the TSS is much higher than the low volume plan.
Might be.
And his first question that he has is, will I achieve quicker FTP results by doing more volume?
Yeah, you could, Jared, but it all depends on what you're accustomed to. So any form of overload is going to yield improvement, assuming you recover properly and don't progress things too quickly. And that would be my concern here. So just because it's more stress doesn't mean it's going to work better for you. It needs to be more stress than what you're accustomed to. But if it's too much more stress, it can kind of derail your training and lead to injury or burnout, something along those lines.
Yeah, it could be worse, Chad, right? It could. He could get slower trying to do the high volume plan if he can't take it.
Yeah, if it's too much of a jump over what you're used to, then absolutely. So if you're new to structured training or just new to Trainer Road, I always recommend that people start with a low volume plan because it's got 3 days of intervals, all separated by at least a day's rest. And it's a good way to, you know, accustomize yourself to this new form of training.
Yeah, and what we always recommend too is when picking the amount of volume you should cycle, it's not how much time you have, but how much stress you can take along with how much time you have. So if you have, you know, you're retired and you're like, hey, I can easily cycle 8 hours a week, but your body can't take the recovery, you're going to do more harm than good. And after a couple months in, you're going to feel horrible and you're not going to be able to get the race results that you want. And like Chad said, it's way easier to start low than go up. I did a sweet spot base low volume one and went through that. Now I'm on sweet spot base mid volume two. And it's a lot more riding, and the first couple of weeks were really hard, but I'm starting to get into it, and it's starting to get easier and feel better. And I know if I would have went to high, I would be just sitting on the couch eating ice cream. I'd be done. Like, you know what I mean? I would have given up. But it was a nice step between those two plans, and I kind of had to mentally prepare, too, to cycle, to go from 3 days a week cycling to six. But it's I'm seeing the results already, Chad. Thank you.
A good illustration of this is professional cyclists. I mean, they have, in many respects, every day that they are awake, or every hour that they are awake, to train, technically, right? And they don't. They sure do put in a lot of time, depending, that varies person to person, but they don't, because they know that it's a combination of how much available time and then how much time they can actually yield benefit from. So you have to take that in.
And on the opposite side of that, professionals, they're really going for recovery too, mm-hmm. right? Like we were talking the other day about Jordan Shinkappi. He was, in Tyler Hamilton's book, he said he was mm-hmm. famous for just like not moving for anything or getting other people to get his stuff. He would just lie on the couch. I think in general, like we have pretty close to darn near perfect training already. Excuse me. Where we have power meters and we know the science behind it. But what we don't have is perfect recovery or perfect nutrition. Nutrition goes into recovery, perfect sleep. And that's like a real kind of area where people can think about to improve in their lives. Sorry. To be able to become a better athlete.
Yeah. Especially with us average Joes. I mean, we have a lot of room to improve there. And the tough part is that it's not as principle-based and consistent. It's going to take you measuring things and trying to isolate circumstance and variables, and but that's part of the fun process. So
yeah, I think average Joe's, the number one thing that we have is consistency. So if you have a full-time mm-hmm. job, it's just life gets in the way. And the guys like Justin Rossi, who he's training all the time, and you know, too, I don't want to be like, I mean, it'd be nice to be fast as Justin, but Justin in that documentary we did about him, he went to Hawaii and he trained his face off. I can look on Strava and he's got like some KOMs there and he doesn't even live there, right? But I'm going to Hawaii in a week for vacation and I'm going to an all-inclusive resort. I'm going to drink and eat and maybe lift some weights. It's going to take me back a little bit, but I'm okay with that, right? Like
right.
I'm an average Joe and I'm just doing this right now. I'm not trying to win a national championship. I want to have some fun mountain biking, destroy some mid-category folk. But not try to beat Justin Rossi or
steal
or
my
you, Jonathan.
KOMs. Steal my KOMs.
I stole one of Jonathan's KOMs yesterday. I'm a newbie mountain biker or this weekend, and he didn't even know it was a KOM. I think he was just riding easy, and I was all out, and I beat him by a second, and I was pretty happy.
Next, he says, I ride with a group in town on Mondays and Fridays. We do an easy 60-minute ride Tuesday and Thursday. We do an easy 60-minute ride. On Tuesday and Thursdays, we do a 1 hour and 20-minute brisk ride. That's a particular time. And Wednesdays, we do a 1 hour and 20-minute hill repeat ride. Weekends are longer and more free-flowing. We'll start to ride outside in March or April, but I want to still be structured. So he says, what are your thoughts about incorporating base or build, et cetera, in other words, the training phases that we have in our training plans, into these outdoor rides? I almost might say incorporating the rides into the training plan rather than training plan around the rides, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, I still think structure and periodization has its place, even if you're doing your work outdoors. I think you're at a junction where you have to decide what you're getting out of those outdoor rides relative to what you could get if you were to stay inside and do these in a arguably more structured format. I mean, I don't know just how structured your hill repeats are. Maybe you're getting a solid workout, but my guess is if it's in a group, it's subject to the same issues that crop up when you ride with people who aren't on the same level of fitness as you are. So definitely still periodize it. Still you know, do the proper type of training at the proper time. And whether or not you decide you can get all that in outdoors, whether you need to do it indoors is for you to figure out in the weeks ahead.
Todd, how do I learn to analyze and understand the data that is being gathered during my workouts so that I can apply it to my future training? That's a good question.
Todd, in large, we handle a lot of that for you by steering you and making sure that the plans are properly progressed and that we update your FTP on a routine basis and that we keep everything scaled to your personal fitness. As far as coaching metrics and whatnot, right now we provide some information, but you know, if you really want to break it down and analyze it, you kind of have to use third-party software. But I'll let Nate chime in on the future of coaching tools with Trainer Road.
Yeah, I think... Chad, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think there's like this mystical area that there's some kind of analytics that it's kind of like taxes. I went to like a big accounting firm for Trainer Road and I was like, oh, I'm going to save so much money because these people know these secrets. They ended up charging me $300 an hour and I didn't pay any less taxes than the accountant that was like $80 an hour. And I kind of feel like past TSS, so we provide the structure training plans, and Chad, you've put a lot of energy and thought into the right kinds of intervals and the right kind of stress, the right time of year going towards your goal event. That's probably, I think, the hardest part to get down. After that, it's, sorry, I'm getting over a cold, so I have a little bit of a frog in my throat. After that, it's getting over, it's being consistent in your training and keeping your TSS consistent and wrapping it up in the right way. And then it's pretty much following your FTP and your power to weight ratio. And you want to make sure that's still going up. If you get through training plans and your power to weight ratio is going down, you're going to look at external factors like stress, recovery, sick, are you vacation, consistency, stuff like that. But in general, I mean, some of the metrics are fun to see, like, and we're going to add these, we already have some of them on our site, but we're going to get more in depth for personal records and that kind of stuff. And those are all motivating, but really the core is just the right kind of training, keeping consistent, and then watching that power to weight ratio to make sure it's still going up. And I say power to weight ratio because your FTP could stay stagnant. Let's say you do a build phase, right? And you go through it, you work really hard, your FTP doesn't go up, but you dropped 15 pounds during that time because you were dieting. That is a total win. Like any cyclist on here would be like, I would kill for that to drop 15 pounds and keep my FTP the same. So what you really want to make sure is your power to weight ratio is going up. Chad, do you have anything to add to that? I know some people get into like these really crazy metrics, but it really is not going to change where you're going.
Yeah. From time to time, I'll dabble. I'll really drill down into data of either a rider I'm coaching or more often my own data. And it's really just like it's a VO2 max test in the sense that it's interesting, but it's not all that fruitful. It doesn't really steer my training. It doesn't really change anything I'm doing. And a lot of those detailed metrics aren't nearly as useful as the basic stuff. Like Nate mentioned, the strength to weight ratio, is my FTP going up? Has it stagnated? Am I recovering from my workouts? I mean, most of the stuff is far more basic than what a lot of these analytic packages offer.
There's probably some people yelling at us right now. They're like, I'm a crit racer and I know that I have 8 matches to burn at this threshold. And if I get 9 matches, I'll win the race. There could be something in there, but I say like 90% or 95% of the equation is putting on as much training stress as you can recover from and being consistent on that and doing the right kind of work at the right time of the year. Yeah. I think no one, even pros, a lot of pros don't do that right. That's where the benefit is, and you will beat your competition. Jonathan, you had something?
Yeah, I was just going to say, as Nate mentioned earlier, I have a tendency to obsess over things a bit. And it's just like I'm sure a lot of us listening to this podcast, it's very easy to obsess over the data. I always tell myself that if I haven't made a change to my training based off of that it's actually proved fruitful, based off of this data that I'm collecting, then I don't need that data. And that just keeps me more focused, so I can put that that mental energy and everything else back into where it really belongs. And what I measure is TSS. I measure and I make sure that all my workouts have IF attached to them, so I have a good indication of that. And other than TSS and time, what I'm measuring there, to be honest, I don't really measure a whole lot regarding actually like my training performance. I know where I should be. And I know what I need to do. Now, granted, I think that the reason I'm in that situation is because I've measured it over time. So, Todd, your question, how do I learn and analyze and understand the data? Time is a key component there. Over time, you'll recognize how your body responds to a certain amount of TSS or different types of workouts, and you'll be able to understand that. It takes time. But if I was to recommend a book, I mean, Training and Racing with the Power Meter is fantastic. What was that? There's another book, Chad, that I read recently. Just it's a quick read, a really quick read.
Yeah, I think Phil Skiba's got a couple. And then Joe Friel's even got one, Working with Power Meters.
Yeah, so those books can be really helpful. They can also get you deep into the weeds. So read everything with a grain of salt and know that just because you can slice the data in a certain way doesn't mean that you need to eat that slice of pie, right? Like you can slice it in any way you want, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it's necessary. So Nicholas, he says, big thanks for the podcast. I've been a Train Road user for over a year, but I've really started to follow the plans this winter, and I'm already feeling fitter than at the same time or point before the start of the race last season. It also feels like an unfair advantage as I race in France, where not many people seem to have caught on to Trainer Road yet. Awesome. We actually noticed that too. I think that, and we'd be interested, Nicholas, in hearing your thoughts as to why that is the case. But there is certainly a hesitance or a reticence towards using the trainer that exists there, we see. So.
And we're not in French.
That's true. That's true. None of us speak French here. So I have two questions linked to training for my upcoming season. As a light, punchy rider, I'm targeting an A race which finishes with a short 2-minute climb, followed by about 5 minutes of rolling terrain to the finish. Based upon previous year's results and KOM times up the climb, I think I can get a 15 to 20 second gap up the on the peloton there, which I will then need to hold to the line. This guy's got a good strategy. Forgive me. He says, I'm already following the mid-volume general build and then rolling road race plans, but is there a benefit in specifically training for this type of interval? For example, a 2-minute interval at 150% FTP, immediately followed by an all-out 5-minute interval? Or would the all-around fitness gained through the build and road race plans be sufficient? Does the training plan address that type of fitness, or should he train specifically for it, Chad?
It does. And if you follow, you know, I hate to keep using this term, but a periodized approach, then we basically address these individually. And then as you move toward your event, they get more specific. You have a really specific vision of what you need. You know exactly what the demands are of the strategy that you're going to follow. So at some point, especially as you grow closer and closer to your competition, I think you should actually create a couple of your own workouts that simulate this particular type of demand, or find one that closely emulates it. We've got race winners that are almost exactly what you're describing here, and these do figure into the rolling road race plan. So you might find a workout that's a good fit. If you don't, you can always create one. But this type of specificity, getting this highly specialized in nature, is absolutely in line, especially if you're targeting a win here. You're not just looking to hang on.
Yeah, I thought this is a really great question, because just in general, like, there are those kind of races where it's like your A race, and you know how it's going to finish, mm-hmm. and you just practice that over and over and over again. It could be a sprint or a 20-minute climb, or like he said, 2-minute effort followed by a 5-minute all-out effort. Mm-hmm. And so how would you break that up into a workout, Chad? Would you?
These are hard work, hard efforts. If you know you're going to have to repeat them in succession, you know, maybe you're going to try this early in the race, see if you can get away, and then I don't know if this is a loop course or not. Then the workout's going to have to simulate that. But in any case, create exactly as you've described the interval, 2 minutes at 150, although that sounds really rigorous, and then 5 minutes all out, which might be 90-95%. If you know you're going to have to repeat them, then the recovery in between them, again, shorten it to whatever's realistic. If you know you're going to sit in for 15 minutes and recover from it, if it fails, then, you know, make them long recoveries. If you know you're going to have to do it again, if it gets reeled in, or maybe it's a short loop, then make the recovery short.
So might he start out with a warm up, and then so that'd be a 7-minute total interval, and then what, like 5 minutes rest in between, and do that 3 times to start, and then kind of do 4 or 5.
Yeah, that sounds totally reasonable. A solid warm-up, because these are, you know, hard efforts, and from what I gather, they come late in the race, so you're going to be sufficiently warm. And then, 7-minute repeats, probably separated by anywhere from 2 to 5 minutes of recovery.
I think 4 of those in a workout would be extremely hard.
Very hard, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
I do a lot of these style intervals actually myself, and I don't, this isn't scientific or anything, or this isn't the exact name, but I always call them race winners, because it's the type of effort that for mountain biking especially you end up doing a lot. Mountain biking, you're generally on a single track, so you're bunched up in certain sections, and then when you get a chance, generally it'll open up onto a short road, and usually that's because it's a climb, and you'll have some room to pass somebody, and you've got to be able to put out that massive kick to string things out, and then you've got to be able to maintain it afterwards. So that structure that we just mentioned there, that's very common, and I've seen that in the rolling road race plan. They're kind of these like race start intervals where you essentially go hard from the get-go, and then you settle back in, but it doesn't really feel like settling back in sometimes.
Yeah, it's a common strategy. It's just about establishing a gap and then or maintaining that gap.
Mm-hmm. I'm doing one of those workouts today in mid-volume.
Nice. Yes, a lot of fun. So he says, his next question, he says, I'm going to have my first peak quite early in the season in mid-April, hopefully while my competitors are still getting up to speed. After managing my form for a few weeks, how would you recommend that I rebuild for a second peak later in the season? And his example that he shares is start another 8-week build and then go right into another 8-week specialty phase. He says his season finishes in September. Thanks for your advice, Nicholas.
Yeah, Nicholas, that's basically what I'd recommend right there is to rebuild and then hit another specialty phase such that you peak your fitness again, hopefully at a higher level. And then use that 1 or 2 week taper leading into your event. If you're going to trim something, if you don't have the full 16 weeks, then trim the build. Use whatever segment or section, 4 weeks, 2 weeks, 6 weeks of the build before you start your full 8 weeks of specialization.
So I just want to reiterate that. I was on Reddit reading someone's comment and someone said about our podcast, everyone thinks they're a special snowflake. And it's like, what combination should I do? But really, Chad, you're following general principles. So when you say rebuild, you're talking about just doing another build block, right?
Yeah, exactly. Just maybe the entire build, the exact same build you did. So, for a time trial, let's say you did the sustained power build, just do the sustained power build again. I mean, the idea is that you came down, gave yourself, you said, held your fitness for a while. And then ideally, I'm guessing you took a week or two where you toned things down a bit and then
that
you jump back
key.
Into to building back up before you re-specialize.
So for me, like, let's say someone has a, mountain biking early in the season, and then late in the season, they're doing a new cyclocross. They peak for their mountain bike season. They go easy for a week or two. Then they do another build block and go into a specialty.
Exactly.
And then if they don't have time to finish that build block, you cut off weeks up at the front or the end of that build block, do you think?
Yeah, and that can depend on your fitness. So say you take maybe a 3-week hiatus where you go to Hawaii or you ride base for a while and your fitness slips a bit. So you might jump back in to your build program at the early 4 weeks, the less stringent 4 weeks. Yeah, if, however, you only take a week off, you're still rolling, maybe still racing a bit, feeling pretty good, then maybe you do the latter 4 weeks, which are obviously more rigorous.
And that would be 16 weeks. What if someone had more than 16 weeks between two peaks? Which
that's,
isn't probably going to happen. Maybe a triathlete who does an Ironman at the beginning and the end.
Then you can actually restart the whole cycle. You can restart with a bit of base work and then head into another build and then another specialty.
Cool. Everyone can bookmark this right here.
Yes,
you just got your formula.
This answers probably about 20% of the questions, 30% of the questions we get. It's always key to isolate principle like that. Thanks for doing that, Nate and Chad.
Yeah,
and
what we need to do, too, is we're going to download Chad's brain, and we're going to put this into a I think we're actually going to put it on our in front of our paywall so that people can say, I have these kind of events. What training plan should I build together? You'll be able to see the actual training plans, but we can say you should do this, 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 and this. And you can at least get an idea, if you're not a trainer or a user, of the periodization. We're working on some training plan incorporation stuff inside the app. And once that's done on the website, I think that'll probably be the next thing we're going to do.
It's going to be awesome. And hopefully it helps all of you weed out the context and, or I should say, understand the context and know what you need to do there.
And two, everyone thinks you're a special snowflake. I had this exact same question to Chad like a week ago, yeah. Right, Chad? I was like, I'm a special snowflake too. What should I do? And Chad's like, you should rebuild.
Same advice that he gave me last year. And actually, Nicholas, I had almost the same season that you had. I peaked in a sub-peak in April, and then after that, in July, I did a rebuild and came back swinging in July, and I had a great year. Really good April and an even better July, so... This advice works really well. Lewis, I'm a Cat 1 mountain bike racer, and I've just finished your base phase. It was the sweet spot base high volume plan. I took some days off and did a second assessment, and that's an FTP test, and I'm in my second week of the short power build. He says, is this okay to take time to recover between training plans, and how much time do you recommend, if any?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you have to pay attention to how you're feeling. If your fitness is on an upward trajectory, you don't want to get too far away from it and let it dip any more than is necessary. Taking breaks between plans, I mean, I try to schedule it or I try to set up every plan such that the final week is a recovery week. And often enough, that's enough to rest you up, let some of that stress absorb and then get back at it, ideally motivated and feeling physically fresh. If that's not the case, there's nothing to say you can't extend that gap. What I wouldn't want to see is inactivity during that time. I mean, still get yourself on the bike, still try to maintain your training schedule, maybe even still include a little bit of intensity, but pay attention to how you're feeling. Ideally, when you start that next training plan, you're raring to get at it.
Can we talk about recovery weeks for a second?
Sure.
I just went through one, and I kind of, you know, I felt bad during it, right? Like I'd gone through 5 weeks and I was like, okay, here's my easy week. And then it was kind of hard. But then when I came into the next plan, it was easy again.
Yeah, I think
if that makes sense, it was weird.
It does. And I think some people get the misconception that a recovery week just feels good. It doesn't. You're carrying so much fatigue into those early days and you just have to work through it. I mean, obviously you're not working hard, but just getting on and turning your legs when you're that tired, that's work. But as the week goes on, you keep that intensity low and, you know, make sure you're doing everything else right, sleeping well, hydrating well, nourishing well, et cetera. That as that week progresses, you'll start feeling better. Ideally so, or ideally to the point that you start that next, you know, next week or next training plan actually ready to hit it hard.
You know what it was, Chad, is actually the last workout, which was an endurance one, was a little bit longer. Mm. I felt so good there. I thought my power meter was miscalibrated. I got off like twice because I'm like, I'm doing way too many watts for this. Like my heart rate's too low. There's something wrong here. It was actually just more fit. And yeah. It's just good for people to get through their brain that the first couple workouts or this wasn't until Sunday when I felt really great. Mm. Like it's going to not feel amazing.
Recovery weeks, many times, at least for in my experience, I don't feel the benefits of recovery weeks until the next week. And that's their intent, right? Their intent is to make you
recover. That's kind of how it works. Yeah, this is a delayed process. You're not gonna see anything happen immediately. Same goes with the training stress. You know, you don't do three hard workouts and then boom, the next day you're stronger. You have to, I mean, everything comes on a bit of a delay.
And so when I first started following a training plan on Trainer Road, I asked Chad, this is when I first started really, I asked Chad if I should take a week off or something like that in between the training plans. And I remember I was pretty nervous about just following through on the training plan, but fast forward a couple years and no regrets there. The training plans are structured to give you the time that you need to recover. If you're following them with precision, and Chad said, making sure that you're hydrated and getting your rest, you'll be all right. So
the one thing too I can say about this guy is he was in, Luis was in sweet spot of high volume. And if that was more volume than he was used to, he might have overloaded his system a little bit and needed a couple more days.
Yeah, exactly. So he's carrying more fatigue than is intended or that his body can really tolerate. So that single week, even riding easy, might not be quite as restful as necessary.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So listen to your body on that one, like Chad said, Luis. His next question, currently I'm using a power meter or using virtual power options since I don't have a power meter. Come mountain bike season, how can I measure my performances during the event? Should I go with a heart rate monitor or just perceived exertion? In my past seasons, I always rely on heart rate monitors, but since I started using the virtual power feature, I don't know how to approach this when the racing starts.
Yeah, Luis, so this is kind of all part of the learning process. Now that you have access to power, even though it's just indoors, you got to kind of start to fold that into your perception. So learn to associate, you know, what certain efforts feel like so that when you know, do it outside, you know, typically I can hold this sort of effort level for only a couple minutes before I pop, or this is a sustainable effort level on a climb. So I know if I go any higher than this, you can tie it to heart rate. But you know, as always, heart rate subject to certain influences that, you know, can kind of steer you off course. So my advice is to, you know, the more you train with power, start to associate that with other metrics, perceived exertion being one of them. Heart rate can be useful, but just try to gain an understanding of what things feel like.
Yeah, I know in my situation, I've been in the same situation as you, Luis. And as Chad said, tying your performance into heart rate or using that to judge or structure your racing on race day is difficult, but especially difficult with mountain bike racing because of the nature of the fact that it's constantly undulating or varying, at least in most cases.
And just racing in general. I mean, a race start, everyone's amped up. Their heart rate's going to be high because they're excited. Perceived exertion is going to be low because they're excited. So it's still problematic. It's just something that improves with experience.
And I think with time, what you'll do is with virtual power, you'll start to understand what threshold feels like, what sweet spot feels like, and hopefully you're already feeling that and recognizing that. What, you know, VO2 feels like and what over that feels like. And if you can tie that into perception, that's definitely your best bet at this point.
But let's break this down a little bit. So if he's in the actual mountain bike race, mm-hmm. he's not going to really want to pay attention to his heart rate, or even if he had a power meter, his power, right? In a race, you're I did that once in a road race, and I got kicked out the back.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you're if you're racing, you're kind of at the will of the stronger guys. I mean, if you want to hang in there and they're hitting it hard from the onset and doing a hard maybe 2 minutes to string the field out, you either go with it or you don't. So it doesn't matter what your power meter says or your heart rate's doing or your perceived exertion is. You do what the race dictates.
Now, if you're the type of guy that's either off the front or perhaps you're split in the middle of the pack and you're riding alone and you are curious about pacing there, then yes, it's really helpful. And I know that for me, on these type of courses that are constantly undulating, I find benefit in thinking back to an interval workout that was similar to my power output during the lap, whatever that race is on mountain bike racing. So we talked about those race start intervals. And in a lot of cases, climbs and mountain bike races tend to be like that, where you start out super hard and then you just kind of maintain before you get to the top. And then you feel like you want to die at the top of the climb. And then there's another 10 of those every lap, right? Think back to those interval workouts and think back to how you felt then. Try to pace off of that. That's if you're solo. Like Chad said, in most cases, you're probably going to be at the mercy of the group. And I will say this much with mountain bike racing, if you are trying to follow a lead that is, or follow a pace that's too strong for you and you feel like it's burning matches over these climbs or over the tough sections of the course, settle back down and go into what you think is sustainable. And if it's a longer race, you'll be surprised. I bet you'll pick a number of those guys off because of the huge, that high intensity, high output, off and on style racing of mountain biking. It can really put a lot of fatigue into guys and make them pop. It's more so than in many cases, any type of steady state race that you see. So
yeah, that's true in mountain biking, but in road racing, just hang on, right? Because they might let up 10 seconds from then, but if you're off the back and that aerodynamic, you don't get the advantages of drafting. That's happened to me, or I've done that to other people so many times. Like, you're hurting so bad, but everyone else is hurting bad, and they might let up in just a little bit, right? You see it in the Tour de France a lot, too, is people, they pop and then go back, and occasionally guys come back, but they just have to pop those guys off the back.
Yeah.
It's a mental thing too.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. So to directly answer your question, Luis, perception is probably your best tool to use right now. I would say, as a mountain bike racer in a similar situation that you've been, that you are, I wouldn't use heart rate, myself. So I have it there and I look at the data afterwards, but I do not pace by that. So,
and if you did have a power meter, I think I would just, in his case, I would, get the TSS afterwards and then make sure that I'm not doing anything crazy in my, you know, I have 400 TSS weeks and I have an 800 TSS week, or I have a 100 TSS week.
Yeah, it's more about the post-race or post-event analysis. It doesn't really dictate what's happening during the event itself so much as proves useful afterwards when you look at, you know, how the race went, and you can start to dissect it. You know, where did I go wrong? Where did I do right? Etc.
Absolutely. John, I'm a fairly untrained mountain biker, another mountain biker. This is good. At 2.3 watts per kilogram, just started structured training for the first time, currently on week 3 of your sweet spot base plan. I'm finding I sometimes have difficulty holding the desired power throughout the last interval in a workout. Similarly, my FTP test had much better results in the first 8-minute piece than the second. Clearly, my endurance needs work. That's what he says. I'm not saying that for you, John. He asks, is it more desirable for training adaptations to reduce the workout intensity to approximately 95% for the last interval if I can't finish it, or to reduce the whole workout to 97% and raise it if I feel good towards the end, or to stop in the middle of the last interval, recover for a short period of time, then finish at 100% again? That's a good one.
Yeah, John, it's a super good question, and all of your proposed solutions are viable. They're all good ones, and they all make sense in certain contexts. With longer intervals, more exhaustive, fatiguing intervals, you can go about it a couple ways. With more high-intensity intervals, where we're shooting for a very particular form of output and stress on the system, it's a different solution. So with the longer stuff, in your case, it sounds like you need, you know, just some strength endurance. You need to be able to push, you know, sub-threshold efforts for longer periods of time. Workouts like that, you know, 10-minute intervals, 20-minute intervals, whatever they are, you can do basically all three of the things you said. Keep the first, say you have four intervals. Keep the quality of the first three intervals really high. You're starting to fade on that fourth one, so you drop it a little bit, but you hang in there. you're not talking about dropping it that far in any of these cases. So all or most of the intended training benefits are still on track. You know, maybe you're a little off the mark, but you're still doing most of what we're after, if not all of it. If you notice at the onset, you're just not that sharp. And I do this a lot. I'll knock my first interval down by 5% just because I know I'm just not feeling good. Maybe I'll feel better after I warm up. Maybe I'll feel better past this first interval. So I'll trim it. And then, you know, I might ride the rest of the workout there. I'm still going to get most of the intended benefit, especially if I can limit it to that 5% decrement. And then with the longer intervals, especially say you get, you know, 5 minutes into a 10-minute interval and you're just falling apart. You can take a quick break, and by quick, I mean quick, just backpedal for like 10, maybe 15 seconds and get right back in there. We're not looking for recovery. We're just looking for something that refreshes you, both physiologically, you know, maybe clears a little bit of the buildup, a little of the acidity. Also psychologically, it gives you just enough time to grab a few deep breaths, refocus, and get back in there. So all of those work.
And John, on the other side of that, so you're an untrained mountain biker, so everyone listening to the podcast, if you have problems holding power on the last interval workout, raise your hand. 10,000 hands just went up. Every single person has problems on that last interval.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's how you know it's right in many cases.
And so this is, as you get, you know, a lot of stuff that separates the lower, you know, 2 watts kilos from the 5 watts kilos is just mental toughness. And sometimes you can't do it, and there's all those things that Chad talked about, but I think there's a lot of times that you can do it, but you think you can't, right? And your brain says, oh, this is really hard. I am so uncomfortable. Shut up, brain. Shut up, legs, like Jens would say, and just go through it. Like, this happens all the time. I mean, how many times, the Justin Rossi documentary,
After three minutes in, he thought, there's no way I can finish this time trial.
He's 3 minutes in his time trial. He says, I can't do it. That's what his brain said. I cannot do this after 3 minutes, right? And he had,
4808, yeah.
Yeah, so
yeah, 48
that's
minutes.
Pretty fast.
Yeah, so
and at 3 minutes in, he thought he couldn't do it. So you are thinking right now, I have 2 minutes or 3 minutes in this last interval, and I can't make it. Justin Rossi then held it for 45 more minutes, right? You can do it for 2 minutes. Yeah, just think back to that.
I always use the same example or a similar example where if you have a 10 interval workout and you're on interval 6 and you're just falling apart, I can't do this, and you start to cut the interval short or drop the power or something. And then magically, or, you know, you fight your way through that, and maybe you fight your way through the 7th one, but then you hit that 8th one and suddenly your power's on the up. And then you hit that 9th one, and you do it even better. You hit that 10th one and it's maybe the best one of the workout. That's clearly not physiological. You know, physiologically, you're getting more and more fatigued. Psychologically though, you're rallying because you know the workout's almost over. So there's so much of it that's in your head. And anytime you start to talk yourself out of it, try to recognize that's what you're doing. You're talking yourself out of it. This isn't necessarily physical. It's in your head.
Jonathan, I actually took a page out of your playbook. Is I was just doing really hard intervals, and I was thinking of it. I was looking back at the times when I dropped people on climbs and when I would win races. And I was, it sounds corny, but I was like saying things to myself, like, you know, about things you'd done before. And like I could do this, and I know I'm hurting really bad, but it's like embracing the pain. Mm-hmm. And I just pictured those guys. I remember those guys, I can think of it, who thought they were going to smoke me, and then they just couldn't keep up, and they went back, and they broke, and I didn't. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to break during here, even though I'm just in my office by myself and no one's watching me. It's a weird thing, but once you do it, you feel so awesome. You feel like, we say winners do train to road, like you're like, I just won that interval. It's fantastic.
Yeah, exactly. Echo to all of that, John. I think Chad gave you some sound advice on what to do if in the case that you actually cannot, and how to understand which approach is the best. But do everything you can, because then on race day, that guy behind you is going to be thinking the same thing that you were, and you're going to be the one that conquered it. So that feels really good. So Paul, he says, hi, folks. First up, I want to thank you for such an excellent product. I've made significant advances in my fitness and learned a ton in the process. The podcast is informative, casual, but also focused and extremely motivated. This is our guy. 6 stars if I could. Pretty sweet.
Yes.
So here's my question. I'm not planning on doing any racing this season. Thus, is there any merit in simply skipping the specialty block and just cycling back through the base and build phases? So, And just so those people that don't know, our training plans, that if you're to build out kind of like an annual plan, so to speak, you have it in three phases: a base phase, a build phase, and a specialty phase. And that specialty phase is where you fine tune your fitness for a specific type of event. So his question is, since he isn't preparing for anything, can he just skip that specialty block, Chad?
Yeah, my concern here would be that you're repeating two similar stress over and over. So if you base, you do base and then you build and go back to base and you build, I think you might see a progression. You might see, you know, from cycle to cycle, a slight lift in what you can do, but you're never really gonna see those big jumps that you get when you specialize. And specialization, or the specialty phases, we do get really specific and in a lot of cases start to trim the stress down. But we're also exposing you to really refined, high-end forms of fitness that you're not going to see, at least not as much of, in the base and build phases. So I still think the cycle makes sense, even if you're not moving toward an event, just in that it changes up the stress and asks more of your body and tasks it in different ways and achieves different levels of, or better, higher, ideally, levels of adaptation.
So might Paul then choose a specialty plan of just the kind of like, that would mimic the kind of intervals that he likes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, do what's fun for you. You know, if you like the punchy climbs, do a rolling road race. If you like to just hammer it out for long periods, do 40 KTT. If you're you know, a mountain biker, choose the appropriate mountain bike plan.
If you know what your buddy absolutely hates when you ride with him, like you know his weakness, train for that. That would be fun, right?
Yeah, that'd be fun.
Just train to drop your buddy. That would be funny. Paul asks again, he says, P.S. if you're so inclined, one miscellaneous question. Any tips and tricks you've learned for selecting a good chamois would be great to hear. I've been rifling through five different vendors so far to limited success. I'm anxious to answer this one. Can I go ahead, guys?
Shoot.
Go ahead.
It's a gear question, right? So for those that don't, well, none of you know, you just hear my voice. You don't see my skin. My skin sucks. It's terrible. So if I were to like take my fingernails and scratch my hand right now, my skin would be red for like hours. It's just really, really weak, and it's really prone to abrasion. So chamois, and sorry guys, I know we're getting personal here, but it took a long time for me to find a chamois that worked. And I tried a huge amount of brands, you know, the high-end Italian, Swiss brands, Assos, Castelli, everything else. And I couldn't find anything that worked really well. And I think it came down to two combinations. Ben Delaney breaks down on Bike Radar really well. He always breaks down. He talks about where the chamois is positioned, and that is really important. A lot of brands tend to have the chamois, like, positioned too far back or too far forward, and it puts it in a really awkward spot. Generally, what it does is it ends up giving you like way too much chamois underneath the saddle, so it rubs on your legs where it isn't even touching the saddle. Or it doesn't give you enough chamois so that, you know, only a small portion of your perineum and everything else is actually supported, but then the rest is just, you know, Lycra on your saddle. So trying to find one that's centrally mounted works. I know he recommends Bontrager. He says that Bontrager and Specialized have great ones that are centered there. And I can attest to the Specialized one, Bontrager, not so much, at least for me. But I found the Holy Grail last year. Like, it's really, really, really good. It's a company called Quare. It's C-U-O-R-E. And they it actually comes from the guy Jürgen that actually owns the company. He was one of the main guys that started Pearl, Pearl Izumi back in the day, and he always wanted to create like this super high-end, really nice brand, but the prices are not high-end, and ever since they sold off to Shimano, they've been making incredible kit. And this chamois that I have, get this, they have like a 2-in-1 skin suit. I was in that skin suit for a whole day from like 6 a.m. all the way until 9 at night, and I didn't even notice it. Before that, by the way, I was like, do an hour-long workout and throw my chamois away from me as fast as I could because I was always getting so irritated. So, and that's in a skin suit. I was in there that long. So Quare is really good for me. That's what I found. And this is individual somewhat. But.
Well, Quare, after you turn me on to it, Jonathan, that's my favorite too. Mm-hmm. I actually have, I have two pairs of their stuff. One's the skin suit, or it's like that one-piece kind of skin.
Yeah, it's like a two in one. So the jersey is sewn to shorts. There's no bib straps. It's really comfy.
Yeah, that one's still really comfortable, but I bought it a little bit too small, so the height wise is not good. But the thing I like about Quare is that you can specify the arm length and the leg length. So like, I wanted a couple extra inches on my legs because I have long legs, and on my arms just to cover some more of them. And or else I'd be like, I would literally in my try. This is kind of funny. In my some of my tri shorts that I used to be in, the tan line that I would have would be the same tan line that like where my boxer shorts would be. So like that's how high up it was on my leg.
Yeah,
it's you like and, kind of an underwear model.
You and your wife have the same tan lines, right?
Yeah. So, yeah. But Quarry, I love it. My wife does laundry every day. We have little kids, and it's the first bib kit I go to, and I just use it. I'm going to use it up. And I have to, well, just buy some more after that. And I also, there's different levels, right?
Yeah.
So we bought the gold, and the gold I really like. And I'm not sure what their prices are. And we got it through a team deal with the Audi team, but...
Yeah, so you can get just the one-off items on their website. And it's like Castelli end or Castelli pricing, that similar stuff. So nice Italian stuff. It's not a... As far as the pricing structure
again?
Goes.
Yeah, because it is. You think it's going to be called Core, but it's not.
Yeah, it's C-U-O-R-E, Core.
And I've actually used the Core clothing, and I got to say, it's quite nice. But first off, full disclosure, my Herbalife 24 team, we're sponsored by Jack Rue, but Jack Rue was my favorite clothing before Core. And then I went back to Jack Rue, the same stuff, the old stuff I had, and realized I liked it as much. Now we have the new stuff, and I think we're the only team Jack Rue sponsors, and we work with them with their R&D. We go back and forth, but I have to say the ordering process, the quality of the clothing, everything about it, the wear, the longevity has nothing but impressed me. And we spent a long weekend in it this last weekend writing brand new stuff. So it's fresh and the chamois, you know, not compressed. So I can't say just yet how it's going to hold up over the longer haul. But I am extremely impressed with this clothing, and their turnaround is tremendously fast. You order something, and you can order one-off items. You submit a design, single order or a single garment, and get it 2 weeks later.
Yeah, I think most companies are kind of going to that model now. It's pretty cool to see, and kudos to Jack Rue on your stuff, Chad. We all get to sit behind Chad and Dave a lot because they're on the same team because they're a lot faster than a lot of us. And we get to see, and their kits do look very good. So
it's so nice. Every bit of it, arm warmers, vests, every bit of it.
Mm-hmm. Dave is our videographer who works here at Trainer Road. Yeah. Hey, since we're on it, Jonathan, I know you're very passionate about this topic. Can we talk about socks for a second? Because that hasn't come up, and I think people will like that.
Yeah.
Take it away.
So I have two favorite types of socks. Swiftwicks are really good. Chad, you like the Swiftwick socks too, right?
Yeah, I love those, yeah.
Yeah, they're really good. So I use the Pursuit 7s. I don't use a wool sock. I don't find that there's much benefit. I just generally find that there's more perspiration with them. That's just me personally. But the Pursuit 7 is the one that I use, and I love it. It's really good. And I get the 7, and 7 means 7-inch socks, and I personally have a thing, like I like mid-calf socks. I think it looks pro on a road biker, on a mountain biker. Triathletes, I get it. You know, you guys don't have to use socks. I think that Swiftwick is fantastic, and another brand that's makes very good stuff, and a lot of people hate on this brand for one reason or another, but Rafa, their socks are like the greatest things you could put on your feet. They're expensive, but they are very comfortable. But I'm a mid-calf guy, and I do have very strange tan lines to show for it, but I like the look on the bike. So,
Jonathan, I have people that can't see this on the podcast, but I have two Swiftwick pairs in my hand right now, both from the Audi team, and I think you sourced both of these.
Yeah.
This one with the red stripe has a little bit thinner top, and I love this one with the red stripe. The older one has a little bit of a thicker top, and it's kind of like, it's almost like the top is folded over. I think maybe it's where they sewed it. It's a little bit different.
Yeah.
But do they still sell this old one? Do you know?
They do,
If someone gets a 7-inch, are they going to get this one every time?
Yep, exactly. If you get the 7-inch, you're going to get the one that's going to be thinner up there in the top.
And that's the one I like, is the one, the 7. That's when I say this one, and I'm shaking it on the podcast. It doesn't really help people. But so the 7-inch, that's the one I really like. And
super good.
I enjoy that one.
Another company that makes good ones are The Athletic. They're a company that makes some cool, crazy looking socks, but they're very comfortable too. So, and I that's a thing that maybe you're underestimating in many cases. If you feel like you're getting hot spots in your shoes and everything else, your shoes could be something definitely that are causing that. But don't rule out socks as another possibility. They can change things. So
I was a Swift Wick or Die sort of guy before. Again, this weekend, but we're sponsored by Giant, so we got new Giant shoes, which I can't say enough good things about, but they each included. So with the shoes came a pair of socks. And so, of course, that's what we rode all weekend, and that's what we're going to ride all season. Very nice. So there may actually be a contender with Swiftwick for me now.
Hey, Chad, I know we're going off topic a little bit, but I think it would be really interesting. So you were at a camp with Justin Rossi and some of the top riders in the country. Mm-hmm. Can you describe the camp and what you guys did? Because I think a lot of the people, even me included, who aren't into that world of the highest amateurs in the country don't know what it's about. And you've said some things about how cool it was and mm-hmm. how it was set up and professional.
Yeah.
Could you describe that a little bit?
Yeah, it was extremely well supported. So we have a soigner, Ronnie, she does a fantastic job, a mechanic, Vinny, both very good at what they do. It was tightly structured. We had 3 days worth of work. We knew what each day was about. It wasn't just go out and log a bunch of miles. We started off with basically a warm-up ride and then a 30-minute time trial. And that was used to see where everyone's fitness is at, seed people for upcoming races, and to make some hard choices in terms of who gets to race what in the near future. After that, we had, another 4 hours of some of the most rigorous climbing I've ever experienced. I mean, geared out, 60 RPM, hanging on for a 12% grade that just stretches bend after bend after bend.
If anybody's ridden in Auburn, California, you know what he's talking about.
It's like straight up, straight down sort of stuff. And there's some rolling stuff that's a little more forgiving, but that comes at the beginning and the end of the ride. So the core of the ride is extremely rigorous. Then the next day, and I don't know how these guys did it, because I have to admit, I couldn't hang on for the entire ride. 100 miles, over 10,000 feet of elevation, same sort of stuff. Extremely steep grades. And this one, we even did certain types of drills. You break up into teams and learn how to pace line down a downhill winding road, taking turns at the front when the road's curving and in this case, open to traffic. But you start to gel. You start to learn how teammates move, who pulls through too strong, just certain things. And I think probably the most important component is you learn to trust your teammates. You know that the wheel you're following has the same intentions. He wants to take care of himself. It's not going to steer you anywhere you don't want to go, but it's crucial to be in those situations where you familiarize yourself with just how scary it is at first, and then over the course of the weekend it gets less scary to the point where by the end of it was downright comfortable holding a wheel very closely regardless of speed.
How many people were at this camp?
I think we had about 30 riders, and then we had a handful of sponsors were there, and then of course the team mechanic and Soigner. So there was probably 35, 36 of us.
Did you guys stay in hotel rooms or house?
No,
or?
We rented a team house. So we went the VRBO route, and we had this massive house with this huge rec room, plenty of beds, massive living room, swimming pool. I mean, it was actually pretty cush, pretty fancy.
Did you guys have a masseuse too?
We did, yeah. So our soigner.
Is that what soigner is?
Yeah. Yeah.
Why don't you just call it a masseuse?
Because
the French
they have other tasks. Yep. She preps bottles and does some cooking and cleaning and laundry, for all I know. Although we might have been responsible for that individually. I didn't do any laundry because I have enough of my new Jack Rue kits to have a clean set every day. But and then on the third day, so after this massive climbing day on this tough Friday, which was 85 miles, 8,500 feet, and then an even tougher Saturday, then Sunday they worked on crit drills. So little things like put two guys up the road and have them try to stay away for as long as possible while four chasers work together to close that gap. Setting up sprinters. I mean, things that are very, very necessary, and a lot of teams don't practice. They just figure they're going to piece this stuff together come race day, and it shows. But you have a well-drilled team who's done these drills and done it with a lot of fatigue in their legs and practiced it again and again, and it shows.
What was it like? So after everyone got back from the ride, what did you guys do?
What
kind of food did you guys eat?
That was pretty great too, because we'd get back and there would be, so we're sponsored by Herbalife 24, so we had their recovery drinks in bottles, mixed and ready to go. There were bananas and little peanut butter banana sandwiches, all sorts of food set up for us. So all that we really had to do...
Fig bars.
And our other sponsor, Fig Bars, which we ate a ton of. And
Nature's
again,
Bakery. We get them here. They make brownies too. And
it's the best racing food, period.
Yeah, I tell myself that it's healthy because it's coming. It's like a sports specific food, and I sure hope it is because I eat a little too many.
They're
of them.
So good.
But it's like those jelly sport beans, right? Those are
exactly.
Healthy.
Yeah,
there's salt in them.
These actually
they say
are though.
Sport beans. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, they're like non-GMO, non-vegan, kosher, organic.
Vegan.
I mean, every all the buzzwords are there, and they actually taste really good all the time.
Do we get those in
I
the
don't
office?
Don't get sick of those.
Yeah, we've got them here. We've got some brownies over in the office.
You hide them, dude. We get quote-unquote sponsored. Nature's Bakery, for those who don't know, it's a fig bar company. They're actually based in Reno, and now they're like national. They're one of the biggest companies.
Yeah, they sponsored Danica Patrick, the NASCAR racer. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but they give us just boxes of it like every week. They come and give it to all of us. Oh, maybe that's why we're talking. That probably is why we're talking about them, right?
Yeah, but, there you go, right? Which, so by the way, none of this stuff isn't paid or anything
we don't
else
get
like
paid,
that.
Yeah.
We're just...
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then once
and
we get
you
back.
You guys ate well too. You guys had like steak. You guys had
some
good food.
Yeah. And that's the other thing. So a lot of the food, Justin did, if not, I think he was involved in every meal if he didn't actually cook the entire meal. But, you know, there's some obvious stuff like pasta and meat sauce and bread and whatnot. But the second night, I think it was London broil and sweet potatoes. I mean, it was incredibly good food. And then a little bit of beer, but nothing excessive at all. These guys are very serious about what they do. But the fact of the matter is, when you get done riding, you really don't have to do much. I mean, Justin cooked dinner, but I honestly think that someone would have done that for him. It's just kind of what he does. But basically, it's just rest and relax. And in this case, all the sponsors were there, so we you know listened to all their pitches, and there was some quote unquote work that we had to do, and we have to you know do certain things to merit our sponsorship with these guys. But for the most part, it's ride hard, relax, get up, do it again.
That sounds awesome. I think the other part too that maybe gets overlooked, but it's the camaraderie. Mm. Mm-hmm. So just spending
Huge.
The time with those guys, now you feel like, because a lot of you guys don't live in the same city, right?
Yeah, exactly. And
now you feel like you're good friends with all of them.
Oh yeah, there was one point on the Friday ride that these guys are just breaking my legs. I'm just about done. I've been riding through cramps for like the last 40-50 minutes. I mean, literally cramping my legs. My knees are veering off course. My heels are twitching out, but I still have to keep on cranking out. Geez, like 350, 380 watts up these little pitches that just never ended. And I'm just about at my breaking point. I swing into this little turnout. And I'm just, someone says, Chad, are you okay? I'm like, no, I don't think I can hang in there. And they're like, just over this last one. This is it. Get over this. And then we just roll all the way home. And I got back in there. And sure enough, I made it home. And we still had another hour and 20 of riding. But the fact is, they treated me, like I'm a teammate, like I matter. And it was a big deal because if they hadn't said anything and just ridden by, that would have been my day. I would have left it feeling much differently. Then I did. I actually feel like they cared.
I've had a friend actually do that going up a climb. I'm like, is it almost done? He's like, it's just around that corner. I thought it was done. There was 40 more minutes of climbing.
Oh, yeah.
I had
for sure.
Mile and a half, right? That's how long you have left always.
There was still plenty of work to be done, but the fact was that was the last tough hill.
Thanks for that, Chad. Sure. Sorry for the... I hope that was interesting to people. It was interesting to me.
Yeah, I hope it is too. And here's the deal. I think that training camp was most effective because there was somebody there that was assigned, Phil Mooney in this case. He's a great guy, and he's their DS, and he's the team manager, everything. He runs a lot of the show over there. And
yeah, he's in that documentary, right?
Yep, yes. He is. He's the one that talks about. And if any of you are wondering what we're talking about when we say Justin Rossi or the documentary, it's a documentary called The Chase that we made, and you can find it on YouTube. Just look it up on our YouTube channel. But
Trainer Road, The Chase.
Yep. So Phil laid out the structure for this, and I think that is so key. If you can isolate for that from a person that's doing the ride, because you guys are doing a long ride, it was really tough, but you still had to have structure in there. And that is so important because the team builds camaraderie just riding together, but they don't necessarily get faster, or better said, they aren't making the most of their time. And you guys had some strict structure that I'm sure nobody really wanted to do. But since you had somebody that was externalized from it that was like, nope, this is what we're doing, then that helps massively.
Yeah, so not only did he lay out the structure, but he made us adhere to it. And these guys are very good at what they do, top end of things. And I don't think any of them would have strayed from it anyway, but there were plenty of opportunities for us to go a bit off course. And, you know, Phil was right there making sure everyone was doing what they were supposed to do when they were supposed to do it.
Yeah, that's huge. Don't overestimate yourself. Don't think that you'll be at the end of a 80-mile ride with 10,000 feet of climbing and thinking that you're ready to do crit practice like these crazy guys did. So,
yeah, there are guys there with like 5.5 watt per kilo mm-hmm. thresholds, right? Like former like pros the previous year.
Oh yeah, yeah. One of our guys, Tim Rugg, and I can name five others, but Tim in particular had with that time trial we did to seed people. I think his average power over 30 minutes was 409. He did like a 7-minute push that was, I think, 470. And this is a guy who weighs 158 pounds.
That's insane.
But he was a former pro, right?
Yeah, as far as I know, he still is considered professional.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's a beast.
And Chad, how old are you now? You just had a birthday.
44. Yeah, so 44. It was. I dare say it was a little more taxing on me this weekend than it was on some of the 22-year-olds.
That makes sense. We're just going to finish up with one more question that we have here. We're going to go through, let's do Mike's question. That'll be the last one. He says, "Hi, I was doing Mary Austin today. I'm typically okay with just black coffee and water in the morning for my workouts that are about 1 hour, even the high intensity ones. But I'm struggling with high intensity workouts past 1 hour. I used to eat a few dates, about 20 to 30 minutes with longer workouts that were high intensity. Should I employ," and he puts this in quotes, "date at 20 minutes in fueling protocol for these longer high intensity workouts?"
Mike, it's clear that you need something. So your sugar stores, your glycogen is running a bit low. It's not getting you through this. And when it comes to high intensity workouts, these aren't the workouts to starve yourself on. Not if you can't get away with it. Shorter workouts, I've found that I can get through the 60-minute jobbers without any extra carbohydrate. But in your case, it sounds like that's not what's happening here. So you need something. I'm not sure dates are the right answer, though. I don't know how quickly they absorb or digest. And I know for sure
they're fast.
They're high in fiber, but so they're high glycemic, but they're also high in fiber. So I do know we eat fig bars and they go down really quickly, but they've been processed at least a little bit. So I think they're a little more digestible. Could be. My advice would be to give it a shot.
Gels, whatever works for you.
Yeah, and I think last time on the podcast too, I talked about morning rides and glycogen depletion, and I realized after I said it, what I really have a problem is it's not glycogen depletion, but like low blood sugar, where I get, you know, you're riding, and it's not mm-hmm. that I'm going to like bonk, but I just get like shaky, and I feel really weak. And that's where we need to do this, Chad. I need to get your glucose monitor. Mm-hmm. Did you buy that?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, so I need to start measuring that on morning rides. And we talked a little bit too. I actually feel the best doing kind of like lunchtime rides. And I really don't have, I can go through 90 minutes and not get that low blood sugar thing. But if I do it in the morning, I just feel like over an hour, I have to eat something or my workout's going to be detrimental. Uh-huh. You know, it's going to be detrimental to my workout.
Uh-huh. Yep, no doubt. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would recommend, like Chad said, perhaps experimenting with what you are using for fuel, Mike, could be beneficial. But don't hesitate to fuel responsibly when you're riding like that. That's no issue.
You have responsibly.
Exactly. That's a key.
And my donuts and coffee aren't.
yeah, exactly. No hoagies, none of that stuff. Well, cool. That covers it for this week, guys. Thanks for all the questions. Check out the previous podcast we did with the Cliff Bar guys. It's episode 21. Hopefully you enjoy that. And submit your questions to support@trainerroad.com, and we will go through more of them on the next week's podcast. Once again, you can find this on iTunes. You can find it on Stitcher, wherever else, and leave us a review there. We'd love to hear it. Thanks, guys. We'll talk to you next time.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.